WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters. Home Goods of Margaretville, corner of Main and Bridge Streets in Margaretville, New York. Now carrying spices, flour, jams, mustards, coffee and tea, organic vegetables and fruits, and local eggs, milk, cheese, and baked goods. And, of course, cooking basics and tools of the trade for everyone at home. Home Goods of Margaretville. Open every day. 845-586-4177 or hgom.net. Rockland Cider Works upstate in Gilboa. An agritourism cidery with vacation rentals on a sprawling former dairy farm. Gluten-free hard cider made from 100% New York State apples. New York State produced beer, wine, and spirits. Rockland Cider Works upstate on Stryker Road in Gilboa. RocklandCiderWorks.com. Watershed, Roxbury's coffee shop and market on Main Street in historic Roxbury. Open from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday through Wednesday, with extended market hours until 6 p.m. Thursday through Saturday. Coffee, breakfast, and lunch in the cafe. And in the market, prepared meals to go and basics like dairy, produce, dry goods, beer, and cider. Watershed, Main Street in Roxbury, watershedroxbury.com, and on Instagram at watershedroxbury.
Hi, this is Andy Cahill, host of the Andy Cahill Show on WIOX Roxbury. You know how passionate I am about music and community radio. You may not know I'm passionate about community solar energy. Delaware River Solar is a community solar company set up to provide an easy and accessible way to begin participating in renewable energy, and it doesn't involve installation of solar panels. Delaware River Solar, a supporter of WIOX, is a solar energy company for Catskills region communities. And when it comes to community, well, you can count me in. I'd be happy to share the details about Delaware River Solar at 845-586-2058 or andy.cahill@delawareriversolar.com.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC, Cable TV, Channel 20 on the campus of SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, worldwide at WIOXradio.org, and on any mobile device FM radio app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good. How are you?
Pretty warm today. Went for a little hike up in Kalialo, and it was like a summer day, man.
Yeah, I know. It's in the 70s today. A little different. Weird, because it was 38 this morning. That one threw me a curveball.
Yeah. warmed up quite a bit.
Yeah, I started with a winter coat and a winter hat on this morning on my first consultation I did.
Yeah, we were up in Bovina and, I had a couple layers on. It was windy as hell up on top where we were. And we went below the crest of the hill in the sun.
Different.
T-shirt. Came right off, yeah.
Cool. Well, I planted some trees this weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I bought some from the county tree sale. So.
What'd you get?
I got white oak, black walnut, American hazelnut, red osier dogwood, and Norway spruce.
Sweet.
Did a little wildlife planting.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Took some time to plant 50 trees, though.
Yeah.
They're just little seedlings. The taproot on them is like 4 or 5 inches. So it wasn't too hard to dig them in. But.
Do a planting bar kind of thing or no?
Yeah. Yeah, my wife has one.
Just kind of heal, yeah.
Yeah, just heal them down. And,
yeah.
But had to get into some rock and some spots and had to dig other holes to get some soil to put back in. It was a lot of work.
I just did some side work, some tree work, and this ash. Man, I am tired of cutting ash. Pretty unpredictable, pretty dead.
Yeah.
And some red maple. Red maple, man. You know, the toughest tree to cut in the woods is a tall, spindly tree that is hollow.
Yeah.
And has white rot. You know, makes it brittle.
Yeah, I mean, even when they are solid, I've seen some of those tall, spindly maples turn 90 degrees on the stump, even with a perfect hinge.
Yeah.
You hardly can control that.
No. No, it doesn't hold a hinge, especially when there's white rot in it. And so that wasn't cool, but got it down.
It's good.
And just finished that little V notch off on my firewood.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's over with, though.
Yeah.
Good. It's a good feeling.
Yeah. So that's all over, you know. Cleaned up the bark. Gonna burn it. Bark coming off all over the place, you know?
Yep.
So, I don't know. Get ready for summer stuff, I guess. Yeah. The grass is growing.
You gotta start mowing.
The grass actually did grow quite a bit. And the apple trees went from silver tip to green tip. So that's what's going on with mine.
Mine are in silver now. Solid silver.
Monday was a day of growth, man. Stuff really took off. And today is going to be pretty good. Yeah. And tomorrow's going to be in the upper 70s.
I saw that.
Yeah.
So it'll be like a summer day.
Yeah, and then it's going to cool down. But, yeah, let's get our guest on. Tonight's show is Meet Wild Whitetail Landscapes' John Teeter, and he is published in Arrow Trade Magazine, Archery World Magazine, Bow and Arrow Magazine, Crossbow Revolution, Game and Fish Magazine, and North American Deer Hunter. He's certified Deer Steward 2, Quality Deer Management Association, and he lives in central New York on 50 acres. Let me see if I can get him on. John, are you there?
Yeah, Ryan, I'm here.
Yep, we can hear you. How you doing?
Good, man. How you doing?
Okay, where exactly are you calling from?
I live in Tully, New York, which is in central New York, just south of Syracuse.
Yeah, been there many times at the Heiberg Forest.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so what was the weather like today over there?
It was 70. I was in my office today working. I've been cutting timber for the past couple weeks, and I've been flying all over the country doing deer habitat design for clients, and I had a consulting visit a couple days ago in between my timber job, and now I'm traveling again, and then I'm headed out to Vermont. So I do a lot of traveling. I go over the country doing this. So
what got you into, before we get into the show, what got you into, white-tailed deer and management of their habitat?
Probably 15 or 17 years ago, I started a project where I was on my family farm, which is down in Allegheny County, New York, and I had done a couple field conversions, basically converting an agricultural setting to better habitat for deer specifically. And so through that process, you know, just that management style and knowledge that I started to gain in those early years kind of just pressed me to understand hunting and you know, habitat and plants and everything that goes along that way. And, you know, my business I started about about 6 years ago. It's taken off. I'm probably one of the few guys in the country to do this. I mean, there's a handful of guys. There's very few in the Northeast. So it's really kind of a niche market, and I work with all types of clients, doctors, lawyers, mechanics, teachers, you know, really wealthy people and people of average means that either own land or lease land. And you learn really a lot from the clients. And, you know, I work with foresters. I got a professional forester that works with me. I've got a professional logger that works with me. And I do the consulting. So I've kind of got a nice little group of people that I work with. And kind of gives me, a little niche opportunity. And I've been pretty lucky to own my own land. I bought 50 acres a few years ago, and we can talk about that later. But been fortunate just to own my own land and show people how to improve property for the better. And I've been lucky. I've worked down in your areas a fair amount. Maybe, 30 or so clients down that way, you know, something like that. So, quite a few clients, and, you know, it's just it grows. But, New York has a lot of potential. It's kind of fixing and changing the culture to be more in tune with kind of what deer need or what they want, and giving them pretty much everything they need to be, either to make them more huntable or to grow populations or to manage the herd, all those things that go along with, kind of thinking about deer.
So, I mean, a lot of people might be listening to this show wondering, aren't there enough deer? What do you think about that?
In some areas, there absolutely are. Most of the time, you see the impact of that just with the mismanagement of the forest. I mean, we could define a young, healthy forest or a healthy forest in a lot of capacity. I am not a prescriber of, silviculture or managing forests for value is necessarily the most important thing. And a lot of times, the mismanagement, the lack of fire, the lack of management in the landscape is really made a detriment to the vegetation. And, the deer populations ebb and flow. There is a lot of predation. The human is the apex predator. And, we've got to look at the strategy behind managing these microclimates of high deer populations. And a lot of it's because I think a lot of people have lost touch with, hunting is part of our heritage, and managing populations and food consumption and all those things that go along with it have been at loss based on, our grocery store, quick, easy, convenient food sources.
How do you think hunting connects people more to the land and its management?
Oh, that's a great question. I find it as my sanctum. I enjoy improving it, and I think every time I look at a new plant or learn something new or watch an animal consume something I didn't recognize before, it makes me more connected with what the animal needs. And it's kind of a double-edged sword. You want to promote deer on the landscape, but you don't want to promote it so much that you're in an overabundance. And I think the connection that you can have, at least with these, these environments that we live in, and recognizing that there is the evolution of management that we've kind of been brought in this earth to do, is really kind of important. I think, again, we've lost touch with that. It's just not commonplace anymore. You go out west, though, and the mindset's completely different. It's part of the culture. They think differently in that respect. I think we colonized, and when we did that, I think we evolved at a different rate here in the east, and maybe our noses are a little too high in the air sometimes. So that'd be my opinion on that.
So, I mean, you mentioned western part of the United States being different. How else does it differ than New York State as far as deer management, deer hunting, habitat, everything you see?
Yeah, I mean, the focus, like from the hunting side, I was talking today with the guys that does my logging, and, we always struggle with having the conversation with clients, and, we're getting the right type of clients that want the improvement, that see the value. I think out west they see more of the value in it. It's ingrained that the hunting is a part of their culture, and as a result of that, they begin to appreciate these things more. I mean, they're sharing the food. You know, they're exchanging, you know, a lot more information. There's a lot more focus on quality of habitat. They also have better soils. So that's a really big thing, is the quality of soil really dictates, you know, the related vegetation and, of course, you know, the size and quality of the deer that they're harvesting out there. And quality deer being in paramount in some of those states, it has a tendency to drive a lot more interest because there is trophy value in that, and people do recognize that. New York doesn't have that same mentality. And I'm not saying trophy management is really kind of what we're doing, but, you know, I'm thinking it more holistically. I should go back and say one thing to you all is, you know, I try to manage low populations on the landscape. I want the lowest population I can get and the maximum pairing capacity based on the vegetation that's on the landscape. That's where I focus, which is a little opposite of how a lot of people approach this. And that makes me a lot more successful.
Well, you know, New York State pretty much owns the deer. I know it's public trust, but it seems like they're responsible for it. How do you think they're doing in New York? I mean, it seems like to me, I remember asked Jeremy Hurst this years ago in Oneonta, and it's like, how do you manage for the same numbers of deer, and yet, you know, we're acting like the habitat hasn't changed since 1950. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think they just haven't done a big enough focus on trying to get people to to consider young forest and field management and some of these practices. Your practices are pretty much simple. You can either mechanically cut something or manage it or spray herbicide. You know, the fact that the state and all these other states culturally haven't accepted fire is beyond me. You know, we've lost and mismanaged most of the habitat in the state. And, you know, I hope people listen to that, because I go to some of these other areas and these practices are so commonplace. And they're permitted, and there's oversight, but the same practices that we could have in some of these areas would really get us a lot further. And watch with climate change. I mean, you're already seeing it now. You're seeing drier summers, more intense. I mean, just wait for forest fires to kind of persuade themselves in these states, and you'll see a change. That may take 10 years, but in 10 years, you know, that could be catastrophic. And not managing fuel loads and all the other things that are on the landscape are problematic. And those things kind of fire me up, because I could manage a lot of these landscapes a lot quicker. You know, when we have these burn bans right now, these are the time to burn. I'm missing windows that I could capitalize on, and that's unfortunate. Now, I'm not saying you can't do growing season burns. You can't. But those are the things I would start to think about. So I don't think the states manage the populations very intensely. They don't have the staff to do that, and I think the habitat is lacking tremendously. And that's why you're seeing the browse pressure that you do, the lack of regeneration. The studies they're doing in Cornell, where they're doing slash browse burns, segregation cages, and they're showing how the forests are damaged. And then the proliferation of non-native plants, that comes next. So there's quite a bit that trifles as a result of, you know, the lack of, I guess, focus on the state. But again, I think it's a small staff, and if we were all in that situation, I don't know how you'd handle it any different.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to get your perspective, but in my humble opinion, I don't think it's the state's responsibility. I feel like we should be incentivizing people like yourself and landowners to do a better job. You know, I don't think the state can do it. It's, you know, it's such an ordeal to manage all these wildlife management units, which are, you know, really arbitrarily kind of drawn across the board, but whatever, in my opinion.
Well, I agree. And I say, you know, to your point, though, the education isn't there either. I mean, well, that makes me have this niche job, is I can provide some of that education. But from, you know, you're right, the landowner has to take the, I think the difference with a lot of the landowners in the East versus the West is there's been an underlining cultural interest in outdoor activities, and that interest is far deeper than some of the clients that I've interacted with in the East, if that makes sense.
Do they have as many absentee landowners out West? I mean, what is it like out there?
There's absentee landowners all over the place. So,
yeah.
A lot of my clients are from New Jersey that work or that have property in areas where you guys work.
Right.
But there's landowners in those areas, and you know the same thing would pertain to out West. I mean, there's absentee, there's residents. So it's a mixed bag. I think the other thing that's pretty dissuading in New York is, I mean, heck. One of my clients recently signed up for this program put on by, I can't think of the name of it, but it was, it's tree retention for carbon sequestration. Like, you know, they're focused on that, and they actually got it completely backwards. But anyhow, he's being incentivized to not cut timber. And, temporarily, that's probably a fine thing. But long term, I'm not following the logic behind that, because there are open prairie settings and things in grassland settings that we can emphasize in our area that do just as well as kind of promoting the same systems that, actually even better, I would say, than just large canopy, you know, trees. And I think we're kind of missing the boat there. So it's like, you know, again, I think the science is a little off base too, and a little bit of a tangent question that I'm going on, but I mean, there's a lot of things that I think about when, you know, you're dealing with the state and what they're really doing. I can tell you out West, the one thing they do is they don't just burn, they don't just manage the timber, they actually put in food plots in some of the areas that I've been. That's great. And the other thing that I don't see a lot in the state lands is I don't see follow-up work. They cut timber, but I don't see the follow-up work after that.
Right.
So the
you mean for like regeneration? Yeah,
managed. Yeah, it's not managed correctly.
I mean,
that's the largest thing that I see.
You know, every decision, management option, it's like life. There's trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one person said I was listening to recently, totally about another topic, but he says there's no solution to anything. There's only trade-offs. And when someone's not telling you the trade-offs, they're trying to sell you something.
Yeah.
So if the carbon sequestration, they're trying to incentivize you from not cutting timber, and they don't tell you about the opportunity cost, which is maybe young forest or younger habitat, I don't know. I don't think that's a rational conversation, right? I mean,
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. And you know, prove to me that those environments in those conditions, like, so I study a lot of permaculture and agroforestry, and those are the things that I employ when I'm doing my layouts and designs. And I don't think it's notable or fully acknowledge the fact that some of those systems are more productive in that carbon process than it is in, you know, at least from the soil standpoint, in comparison, you know, to you know, these large mature climax forests. I don't think that is the right perspective on things necessarily.
Yeah.
And just to say, like, for example, look at the grassland. So I go out and I work with prairie lands all the time. And I go out to the Midwest and there's these large prairie lands that they're restoring. And you can dig down and you can keep digging 10, 20 feet. The soil is so deep. If you look at the soils that we deal with, they're degraded. They're all weathered. And so there's over-application of nitrogen, you know, NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And we don't know how to build soils here in the East. And there's a whole host of different things that you can improve on. Like my property and how I'm managing properties, I haven't used fertilizer in 7 years. I don't use fertilizers on any of my food plots, and any of my clients, I try to push them not to use fertilizers. We have natural amendments. I'm driving to Vermont next week. I'm working with clients. I'm actually stopping at a quarry. I'm getting natural soil amendments, driving them back, putting my, you know, and so there's natural ways to amend your soil. There's a lot of things that you can do that are simpler, cheaper, and we're buying into, you know, capitalism in a lot of the sense. And I try to save clients money, and it goes so much further than just deer hunting. And I really kind of think there's a lot more to the process of, you know, invigorating our soils. I spread sea salt all over my woodlots. When I do a clear cut, I spread sea salt all over the place. And, You know, we lack sodium. We lack trace elements across our landscapes. There's so many things you can do to improve the environments that you're in. I mean, it's just a simple example. And you can get sea salt for free if you want to drive out to the ocean. I mean, if you want to do things simplistically and cheap, you can. And I don't use fertilizer. And I know that's a tangent thing, but there's a lot you can do on your landscape to improve it and to improve the environment for, you know, a whole different host of species.
What's the sea salt do?
So, we have sodium-deficient soils, right? That's pretty much across the landscape. I'll give you a quick example. So, sea salt has, 60 trace elements like cobalt, arsenic. Like, these trace elements are really important in the building of chlorophyll and other, different, organisms and plant life across the landscape. Now, you can poison your soil. Or you can promote things in your soil. So adding trace elements, just like in your areas, you're going to be sulfur deficient, more than likely boron deficient, zinc deficient. I don't need to go down and take a soil sample to tell you that. I know what it's like. So using some of these trace elements to help improve those increases the palatability of plants. Increasing the palatability of plants increases, obviously, attraction. Attraction increases huntability. And so those are the things that, I focus on working with clients. I mean, it's just a simple example. Sea salt happens to be really, really cheap. I can get it, $10 for a 50-pound bag. So I, just a cheap way to improve some of the landscape application options for you. I've been doing that for 10 years. When I started doing this, these are the things that, I try to focus in on. And I'm working with Cornell right now on a couple projects with soil amendments and how to not have to use fertilizer and try to promote commercially new ways to help people save money. If I can do long-term, improvements to soil and I don't have to till or I don't have to apply amendments, 10 or 15 years, then, I'm improving carbon sequestration. I'm improving the soil quality, infiltration, all the things that come along with that. So I'm building shallow soils and making them deeper. I'm improving the biomass so I can have more organisms, more microbial activity, those type of things across the landscape. So there's a lot of things you can do to kind of improve the soil and its related health, and necessarily the plants, and that's kind of where we struggle a lot in the landscape.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Meet Whitetail Landscapes, John Teeter. John, am I saying your last name right?
Yeah, yep.
So, what do you think New York has going for it? As someone who deals with a lot of clients, what are our strengths? What are our weaknesses and opportunities and threats?
Well, I think New York has, you're all familiar with any fungal diseases and insects that we're dealing with, but I think New York has, they have the opportunity to, they've got a lot of forest land and there's a lot of private land. And it's really easy to take a forest land setting and manipulate it for a lot of these young, or a lot of these mammals that we're focusing on. 80% of the animal species that we're working on, live at the ground level, and we don't recognize that frequently. We're so used to the, these open aris climax setting forests that are in that 90, 100, 120 year range that haven't been managed correctly. We don't recognize any difference. So there's a lot of opportunity across New York State to kind of improve, most of these woodland settings and or forested settings, and I think that's a huge bonus. It's just tapping in and kind of setting up and arranging these properties so they become more huntable. They're optimized, and there's a lot you can do from a landscape setting. Take my 50 acres. It was even age forest. No timber stand improvement, no forest stand improvement activities, none of those things that are meaningful to deer, none of them were happening in the landscape. 4 years later, I killed 150-inch deer, was one of the biggest deer killed in my area in just 4 years. And, forgetting the trophy piece of that aside, I was able to attract older age class deer, and it was as a result of all the improvements that I make. And, very highly precision, variable thinning, a lot of things that I did over time. I took a lot of the older age timber out of there. I left a lot of wolf trees. I managed some of the younger, you know, stand of trees that were in certain pockets. And you know, you can really take a complete woodlot and really turn it into something highly productive. And I think we tend to overlook that. And just the woods are what they are.
So what's your typical, you know, first client interaction? Someone just calls you up, maybe you do a consultation. Where does it all start? I mean, what's a very typical interaction?
So typically the clients that I work with, you know, we go through the questionnaire process. Basically, it's kind of, you know, they're interviewing me as much as I'm interviewing them. You know, my services are, you know, they're not cheap and they're certainly not free. But, you know, it's really figuring out their interest level. Once they get through the questionnaire process, I give them a quote, and then we'll schedule a visit. You know, I only do so many clients per year, and I'm, you know, I'm capped out right now until out through 23. I don't have any more availability for clients. So I'm pretty much, I'm booked. And what, and why that is because, you know, the process in this is so, you know, I give you rules of thumb. By the time I'm leaving, you're knowing what trees to cut, what trees not to cut, whether it's for long-term harvestability reasons or it's short-term structure composition, diversity, those type of things. And, you know, when you have a plan in action, it's like building a house. You can build a foundation, but if you don't have all the other pieces together, you don't really go anywhere. So you've got the land. You've got to do something with it. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, people are spending a ton of money on these hunting properties. It's a drop in the bucket to hire somebody to architect it. And like I said, you know, my forte, I've hunted the Adirondacks, Southern Tier, industrial parks, suburban areas. I've hunted all across New York State. And, you know, all my deer, if you go to my website, all my deer were killed in Syracuse. But I've hunted all over the place. And, you know, the reason being is so I can learn, you know, what is it like to hunt in the low deer density? What is it like to hunt in high deer density? How do you manage the differences? What's the style of hunting? And there's a lot of knowledge that not just culturally, but, you know, intuitively and based on experience that you can bring to the table from a hunting perspective, wrapped up in understanding how to manage a woodlot, how to manage old field. And there's a lot that goes into that. And you could do it, you know, I try to do it on the cheap with the clients, you know, give them the cheapest option. The sea salt thing is just, you know, it's a ridiculously funny thing to think about, but it's really a cheap option for clients if you want to try to improve the soil.
So you knowing which tree to cut, which to leave, we talk a lot about that on the show. Sure. What's a good tree to cut and a good tree to leave in your mind?
Depends on the location. If we're trying to create structure, is it a tree that you can hinge cut? Is it a tree that you can fell? You start there. What's the health and status of the tree? Like you're talking earlier about red maple, any rot, any fungal diseases you're dealing with. So, you know, get rid of the, you know, dead disease and dying. And then, you know, you focus from, you know, what's quality and what's quality in our areas and how we define quality is fit form. You know, if you were really to look at it from an ecological standpoint, the way that we manage forests, I think, is completely incorrect. We don't focus on root growth. We focus on development of stems. And sometimes we focus on tops. So, you know, you got to look from the top to the bottom. You got to understand the root structure through the stem to the top. And we think about harvestability. Harvestability is part of the equation. That's not a healthy forest isn't focused on harvestability. It's focused on variability. And I think there's a big loss in the equation that a lot of people don't see. And I'm in the business of helping landowners connect with foresters and loggers, and I see it much different from my forester and much different from my logger. I also, depending on what the client's looking at, is, you know, just because, like, witch hazel, for some reason, witch hazel is popping out my mind. And I just did a podcast recently on how to replace non-native plants and what species to employ. You know, when you're looking at your landscape and you've got a lot of, like, black locust is a great example. A lot of times you'll find in disturbed sites black locust bush honeysuckle. And they're companion plants, essentially. Both nitrogen fixers, both have a lot of toxicity in the soil. They eliminate plants from growing next to them, and those will be gone before I'll kill a native tree, regardless of its form, health, or status. So there'll be a decision I make there versus selecting, you know, a tree that may not have good form, that may not be a, you know, that may be a calling tree eventually. But a lot of times, you know, if you're dealing with a forest that's even age management and you're going in, I'll select a group cut in certain areas. I'll clear cut in certain areas. I may leave old forest stands in other areas, and I'll leave a lot of wolf trees. And I stick to managing, you know, dead decaying trees. Instead of cull trees, sometimes I'll get rid of, I'll employ some snag trees in the denser areas. I mean, there's a lot of variability, but when you go through the process and give kind of a rule set to the client, they should be able to manage the forest, you know, with their own set of eyes. And I think we don't give ourselves the credit we deserve. And I don't necessarily think you have to be schooled in all this stuff to be intellectual and understand it. You should understand your tree species and its status, but maybe that tree species that you're working with may not have value per se, you know, from a standpoint of a timber standpoint, but they may have a lot of wildlife value. Beech is one of those fine examples. Yeah. I save as many beech trees as I can. And it's a poor thing that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when they started to get rid of all the beeches and they put a ton of herbicide in the ground and they destroyed the forest. That was a poor decision. You know, ever thought that was a good idea?
How do you think they destroyed the forest?
I think over harvest. I've seen over harvest in those areas, and high grading obviously promoted the beech. And then as a result of that, everyone got this knee-jerk reaction that we need to kill all the beech. And, you know, whatever herbicides they were using at the time ended up really kind of setting back those forest stands. I worked on a forest stand not too long ago. Again, I'm not a professional forest, but I walk in there, and not only did they kill every beech, they killed them 25 years ago. And as a result, the regeneration in that area, it decimated that area. There's very limited regeneration. That area was designed to develop oak, and they could have created exclusion for oak. They could have done a lot more. They could have emplaced or planted oak trees in those areas. What they did is they cut and killed every beech, and there was literally zero trees. 20 years later, there's still zero trees in that area. Some of it has to do with disease and browse pressure and those things. But, you know, I'm trying to save, you know, even though a lot of the beech have tankers and they die from the interior, you can see that. They're one of the predominant species in our areas that we overlook. And you'll see the young, the mammals, a lot of the small mammals live and die off that species. And you know, that's the ebb and flow in animal populations is directly correlated to some of those tree species, including bears. And we overlook that quite a bit. So I'm all about saving the beech, you know. And I think that was a poor decision. I see it mismanaged on most of the properties that I'm on.
You think it's deliberate, is what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and if it's a, you know, let me step back. If it's a clonal tree that has, you know, it's prone to disease, I'm not saying don't kill it. Kill it. If you want to kill it, kill it. But the healthy beech species that are across the landscape, we could have managed those a lot differently.
Yeah.
And I just see this massive influx of just killing everything. You know, same thing with hickories. I see hickories mismanaged all the time. Not a lot of value,
right.
You know, so, you know, but again, it's not a tree that's promoted per se.
Right.
There's a lot of value in the landscape.
Absolutely. So, John, you say something?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to pick your brain a little more about beech as an interfering species, because, I mean, what about in other areas where I'm thinking higher peaks of the Catskills and Adirondacks, where you can find stands of this 500 acres or more of just beech disease so thick you can hardly walk through. I mean, where do you see it becoming an interfering species? Because I know I spend a lot of time in western New York, and you go for a walk there, and you can find some beautiful beech trees. I'm with you there. Don't cut them. Don't cause them to sprout out, because they don't get the disease so bad out there because they're not as dense. But some areas, they are interfering. And what's the difference? Because I hear you on bears. I hunted the stand of trees this year that you couldn't walk without stumbling upon, you know, tripping over bear nest damage all up in those trees. I think I saw four or five bears on that hunt, and it was great. But they don't fruit that often. So I guess I want to see where that line might be drawn for you.
No, and that's true. I mean, you nailed it. I mean, there's some areas where it's overabundant, right? So I think it's just balancing this composition of species. And like you said, picking the healthy trees and promoting those, you know, promoting any clonals that are tied to that. You know, there's been a lot of good, I think, research done over the past 10 years on mistakes that were made in the past. And, you know, the way I look at it is it's not something that we focus in on as a predominant species, a predominant tree that's going to provide, you know, a large supplemental set of food for our, you know, small animals, et cetera. Like, I'm not saying that. And I'm saying even the same thing applies to oaks. I mean, you know, depending on, you know, the weather conditions and everything that, you know, pertains to, you know, acorn production, you know, that variability isn't something to be highly relied on. But from just a composition standpoint, like ironwood is a great example. Ironwood across the landscape is looked at as kind of a fence post tree. And it is, but the catkins it produces is very useful for grouse. So, you know, we're looking at any seed-producing trees. Tulip poplar is a great example. Those are great species for bees. And you've got to look at just their benefit across the landscape. But to your point, I think if there's too much of something, it's always a bad thing. If you put too much sea salt on the landscape, it's a bad thing. So it's kind of everything kind of in moderation is probably more what I'm getting at. And I just didn't like this extreme examples that I've seen on a lot of properties. And again, I don't even know what chemicals they use, but it seems a bit destructive to me what they had done previously. And again, I mean, it is for a lot of times promotion of those trees that bring value and value. You know, the idea that capitalism society that we live in kind of negates the wildlife side of things. And there certainly can be a balance in all of that.
Well,
and I don't think you go too heavy on cutting or too light sometimes. And again, you know, that's a balance of that style. And that's what I work with the clients. You know, how heavy do you cut in this area? How much understory do you promote? There's a balance of all that.
Yeah, I can't speak for Western New York, but a lot of the mismanagement I feel in our neck of the woods is from the lack of markets, not from capitalism. There's no low-grade markets. So the beach that we have today is there because those trees can't pay their way out of the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, doing a clear cut, a true clear cut in the Catskills, it's not being done in any significant way. Because it would cost $300 an acre or more, you know. But I guess, you know, that person killing the beech with glyphosate probably is probably to open up maple, probably sugar maple, hard maple, ash once upon a time. But I don't know. I haven't been there. Do you think there's any place for non-native plants in the landscape?
Non-native plants and promoting non-native plants in the landscape.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. I mean, Norway spruce is a great example.
Yeah.
that's going to replace the hemlocks today, more than likely. So I would say, yeah. You know, I see a Chinese chestnut.
Yeah.
That's a Korean chestnut, Chinese chestnut. I'm trying to think of other species that I see that people are promoting. Asian pears. Sawtooth oaks. That's another example I see quite a bit on people's properties.
Apple.
You know, they're wildlife beneficial trees, but, you know, a sea buckthorn.
Mm-hmm.
See that on in hedges now. That's a permaculture thing. It's an edible berry. It's a Russian tree. I promote, when I'm doing, like, apple tree plantings, I promote comfrey. And daffodils, they're, again, pollinator plant, non-native, the daffodil, Russian comfrey, obviously it doesn't sound American, it's a mineral accumulator. And so those are complementary plants, those are not native, rhizomial, those comfreys will spread if you cut the roots and displace them. And so, you know, there are plants that I promote in some of the designs that I'm doing, but, you know, they're not, it's trying to focus on the native plants, at least ecologically. The soils are designed for those plants more than likely. So, you know, why not try to just, you know, and I don't do the spraying. I hire guys to go out and spray, but if you're going to take out some of those non-native plants, you know, there's so much online information. Figure out when the best time to kill it. You know, I kill beech. If I'm going to kill beech, I'm killing it in the summertime. It's the most productive based on the type of chemicals that I'm using. And I said, don't kill beech, but if you are, you know, there's time and place for everything. The honeysuckles, I'm killing them in the wintertime. I'm not killing them now, and I'm killing them in the summertime.
Yeah. How do you kill them? How do you kill honeysuckle in the wintertime?
I kill it in the wintertime with glyphosate and diesel. I'll use triclopyr and diesel sometimes.
Basil bark spray?
I won't basil bark it. I'll stump cut it.
Oh, okay.
Yep. I'll stump cut it and stem spray it, typically.
Hmm. Yeah. Hey, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. This show is flying by. This is Meet Whitetail Landscapes, John Teeter. I know you got to leave a little early, John. Wanted to ask you, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and you were saying the first thing you do after having a free 30-minute consultation with a client is, you know, is first you look at where you think the deer want to be.
Yeah.
How do you figure that out? Because every hunter wants to know that. Come on. So give us your secrets, you know, hand them over.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I can pick a lot out just based on topography.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you can look at just kind of the induced edges. So you got different vegetation types, different ecotones. And what you look at is you look at, okay, is that going to be likely more of a food area? In some of the areas, there's a lot of cover. Like one of the issues that you deal with on your way is you got a lot of mountain laurel in certain areas. Mountain laurel's, you know, really kind of a cover plant, but it ends up basically taking up a ton of space. And, you know, if you find spaces in that mountain laurel with decent topography, usually there's pockets of trees together, it's likely going to be areas that deer frequent. So sometimes it's finding accessibility in dense areas. If there's a clear cut, and I'm looking on a map, I'm usually looking around the edges. If you're dealing with topography, you're looking for benches. You're figuring out how deer kind of travel across those terrain features and topographic features. And again, differences in density of vegetation, you know, is really critical to how they co-locate. And if there's a food value component of that, they're likely going to spend more time in those areas. And it's just paying attention to the scat and the tracks and, you know, just the connectivity and lack of fragmentation across the landscape. Everything kind of just interacts, you know, I think pretty well. And, you know, I can look at a map and generally tell where the deer are going to be, but you got to truth data. You got to get on the ground. You got to find those locations and start to put a story together how deer are using the landscape. And I just did a podcast a couple weeks ago. I have my own podcast on the Sportsman's Nation, but I did a podcast with another guy, and I talked about how deer thermal regulate and how thermal regulation, so their body's ability to cool and heat up, keeping that kind of homeostasis, that equilibrium, that is the one of the biggest things I use to target in and figure out, you know, how to kill a deer. I can have an idea where it wants to be based on its focus on cooling or heating. And it's thinking more and humanizing some of this stuff, but that's the way I use a kill the bucks that I go after. And I only hunt a few days a year because all I do is deer property management on clients. You know, I'm working all the way up to hunting season, and I work into hunting season, and I take a month and a half off, and then I continue to work with clients through the rest of the year. And I basically my whole life is deer. So, I mean, that's all I'm doing is studying deer every day, pretty much.
So what other wildlife benefits other than deer do you notice in some companion species maybe you see moving in after you do a cut or any type of planting or something? What's right behind them on their toes?
Yeah, you know, I just think it depends. I mean, the most obvious I see all the time is grouse. I see, you know, large influxes of grouse. I don't know if you guys know Todd Waldron, but, you know, he's a local guy. He's north of you guys. I mean, he's with the Rough Grouse Society. A lot of improvements I'm making are helping some of these umbrella species. I mean, I do some work in riparian areas, and the salamander populations, you know, we do a lot of management in those areas to help, you know, promote certain species. I've got a wildlife biologist I work with. He kind of handles a lot of, he gives a lot of tips and tricks in managing salamanders. He's, and you would think I'm doing deer stuff, but I deal with a lot of riparian habitat, and because there's a lot of vegetation, there's likely a lot of mineral content in there, and there's a lot of food value in there. So you're seeing a lot of beneficials based on that. And, you know, other things, we're doing pollinator habitat. Those are promoting and propagating forb content on the landscape. Forbs, think like broadleaf plants, clovers, that's a good example of one. Those are consumables. Those are something deer like to eat. So, you know, promoting those on the landscape is really important. So it's kind of holistic. It's thinking the entire ecology, and it's focusing on a multitude of things. A lot of birds, a lot of different bird species. I work with an ornithologist, studies birds. And he's taught me a lot about, you know, how to design. Like, I was dealing with a property in Vermont where we were dealing with, like, meadowlark, like a bird likes these open land settings. And they like certain cadence of trees across the landscape. Like, I would have no idea if I didn't have him as a resource, you know. So it's kind of connecting with the right people, getting information. Okay, you know, if I'm gonna promote, like, you know, woodpecker habitat, you know, what am I doing to promote this species? You know, and so, you know, they've kind of taught me, well, you want to keep these selection of trees in these areas, you know, et cetera. And yeah, I don't think I'd know that otherwise because I'm kind of just a deer-focused individual. So I've learned a few things along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if the deer are happy and their bellies are full, then that's when the forest can actually grow something. But that's just my opinion, yeah.
No, I think you're 100% right, 100%.
So here's a little scenario, last thing to leave off with maybe. We have a lot of red maple in the overstory, right? And we have a lot of New York and hay-scented fern on the forest floor. What does someone do? I know there's topography issues and, you know, what's there that's going to influence how you manage. But just generally speaking, what would you do with someone who's got an overstory of red maple and a lot of fern in the understory, no regeneration?
Well, typically I'm going to either work with somebody that can, depending on the size of the area, you know, the standard area, I'm going to get somebody in there that's going to be able to spray large areas. Now, what I've done with some clients is, you know, again, you know, how comfortable are they with herbicide? Certain herbicides, I think I would use Ouse would be the typical herbicide I would spray in the summertime, trying to remove that understory layer, you know, of the fern. And then once, you know, it takes a while to get rid of that fern, then I would start making decisions to remove overstory trees. But I would start with the fern and then go from there with the overstory trees. I think it's problematic. And again, the hay-scented fern is, like, not really an edible, you know, plant for deer. They will eat some of those species of fern. You know, Christmas fern, there's variation of ferns that deer eat, but certain ferns they don't. So if I'm trying to promote understory development, that's typically what I'm doing. And once I do that, I'll do a controlled area and just see how well I can control an area before I get, again, infiltration of, you know, the hay-scented fern in those areas. So that's how I would kind of handle it. And I could do some variable thinning in there as well just to get, you know, a little bit of gradient light and filtered light to the ground to just see what happens, you know, otherwise. But if it's just a full, you know, complexity of fern that I'm trying to get rid of, I might just spot spray it and open it up, maybe a little gap and see how it does. Does it go away? Does something grow there? What grows there? Is it something I like, something I don't like? That's usually the next phase of it.
What's something you wish people knew about what you do?
I guess the biggest thing is that, you know, I gave the example of my property. You can go from 0 to 100. You can go from 0 to 60. You can go from 0 to 20.
your interest and investment in your property is worth it, you can take the worst hunting property in the world and make it awesome. I have done it with tons of clients, and you can educate your neighbors. You can change the whole hunting dynamics in your environment. I mean, nobody in my area is managing deer. The past couple of years, I've killed the three biggest deer in a 10-square-mile radius of me. Everyone knows who I am. Everyone knows who I'm doing, and everyone wants to be part of what I'm doing. You can change the behavior of your area. There's no and, if, or buts about it. I'm changing the culture in my little microclimate because of what I'm doing. And I help a ton of people for free, and I do it because I want them to recognize that they're empowered to make change. You got to get with the right people. And I don't know everything. I don't know everything. But, you know, I think my biggest takeaway and what I've been doing is empowering people and putting them in the direction, you know, right, wrong, or different. If I don't know something about trees or how I should manage this forest, you know, for future timber harvest and make sure that we're optimizing that, I have a guy who does that. Because my opinion is not a professional opinion. And I'm clear on that. But, you know, when it comes to optimizing a property, that forester, you know, and I'm working on a bunch of foresters' properties this year. They're hiring me to work on their properties. And that kind of says that, you know, we're changing the way they approach managing timber stands and having a little bit divergent view from maybe the traditional education that they got. And I just see things differently. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I want people to be empowered and recognize that you can do something with your property. You just you've got to open your eyes to it and want to do it, you know, and maybe you're benefiting a larger ecological scheme that you don't even recognize. And connecting yourself with the right people is really critical. And that, you know, that's what my business does.
It takes work, and we appreciate your time and explaining that tonight, but believe it or not, that's the hour. So
all right.
Thank you for coming on tonight, John, and it will be archived on Catskill Forest Association's website by next week.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Good night.
Yep.
That's all the time we have, and see you next week.
Good night, everyone.
All right.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. Then the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way.
WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters. Peace, Love, and Yoga. For experiences designed to feed the soul, delight the senses, and promote good health. Yoga, meditation, acupuncture, art, music, wellness talks, pain management, nutritional counseling, and fitness plans. Beginners always welcome. And Peace, Love, and Yoga presents Bountiful Beauty, a celebration of art and nature featuring the work of Roxbury artist Deborah Ruggiero, on view through Saturday, May 21st. Peace, Love, and Yoga, PLAY, on Hillcrest Drive in Roxbury. More information at 607-326-6333. 607-326-6333 or playcatskills.com. Hanna Mountain Resort and Country Club with 29 guest rooms, restaurant, and bar, specializing in wedding packages, including rehearsal, dinner, ceremony, reception, farewell brunch, and accommodations for guests. And golf memberships are available for Hanna's 18-hole championship golf course. Information at hannacountryresort.com or 845-586-4849. What the soap? WTS and Company in Prattsville for soaps and lotions made on